Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Shawley, bringing you the best of my Times radio show. You can listen to Politics Without the Boring Bits Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times radio app. Coming up on today's episode, we rewind the clock 30 years ago. John Major delivered his back-to-basics speech designed to draw a line under lots of Tory sleaze.
The old values, neighbourliness, decency, courtesy, they're still alive. They're still the best of Britain. They haven't changed. And yet somehow people feel embarrassed by them.
Didn't really work out like that. We'll find out what went wrong, any parallels with today, including hearing from Hal James, the political secretary to John Major when he was in Downing Street. In a moment, we'll have Indian Knight and James Marriott. But now, well, normally we take a look at what we learned this week. But on Thursday night, the Westminster Correspondents' Dinner took place in Westminster. It's like the White House one, but slightly less fancy. Rishi Sunak does jokes, apparently. So today, let's take a look at what we learned from Rishi Sunak's stand-up routine. We learned that Rishi Sunak is not looking forward to a Tory party conference karaoke.
Now, I've heard on the grapevine that Nadine and Boris are doing nothing compared to you. Liz Truss is apparently covering Shaggy's It Wasn't Me. And I will be performing Elton John's classic Tiny Dancer.
It's a classic. We learned that he is really enjoying the Lettuce's comeback.
And I'm glad to see actually that Liz Truss has been quietly reflecting. not least on who's to blame. HMT, of course. OBR. B of E, IMF, HMV, DFS, ACDC. In fact, I can't think of an acronym in British public life that hasn't yet been blamed. Except perhaps the IEA.
Yeah, the Institute for Economic Affairs, of course. We also learned that even he's got bored of ITV's political editor.
Even I couldn't get away with making a speech shorter than one of Robert Heston's questions.
We learned that, yes, Keir Starmer is from London.
In fact, he's so out of touch, he thinks the Angel of the North is a tube stop in Islington.
And we learned that after 7 bins and meat taxes, other things are safe too.
The ban on Christmas. I've scrapped it. The plan for pubs to open just an hour a day, I've scrapped it. The ban on Strictly, I've scrapped it. And of course the ban on puppies, I've scrapped that too.
And that's what we learned from Rishi Sunak's jokes. Right, now it's time for these two.
The Columnists with Knight at the Marriott, India Knight and James Marriott on Times Radio.
Oh, it's not the one.
Is it finally over?
No, it's absolutely not. Have you been tampering with the machine?
I think that we've all accepted the jokes got old. We can move on and leave my humiliation in the past.
The joke is fresh.
Yeah, I think it's good. It just keeps coming back. Have we got it?
I was hunched on my bedroom floor of my laptop, frantically battering away at my column.
Oh, thank goodness. I feel like
I thought I was finally free. I thought you'd finally decided to stop bullying me and we were going to move
We're not bullying here. It's all part of including you in the family.
Including me in the
That was a good snort there as well.
I stopped snorting as well. I'm just embarrassing myself on radio in every single way.
How are you, India?
I'm very well, thank you, Matt. How are you?
Yeah, very good. How's your Substack doing?
It's doing really well. It's weird. It's great. It's doing much better than I anticipated, and that brings a certain amount of pressure, but it's great. Loving it.
Do you know what I like about it?
What?
Most Substacks that I've signed up to are all dribbling on about politics and what they think about things and basically the columns that nobody else wants to run. And yours is like, here's some lovely fairy lights. And I was like,
yes.
I agree. I'm a subscriber. Fairy lights.
Yeah.
That's very kind. Thank you. Nice things. Nice things. Nice things. Nice things to celebrate.
Nice things, exactly. So there we are. You can find India's Substack wherever you get your Substack. I don't really understand.
On Substack.
Indianite.substack.com.
There we are. Well,
she's really professional at this now.
Yeah, exactly.
I am.
Very good. Right. Let's talk about cars. Rishi Sunak is said to be planning to block councils from introducing 20-mile-per-hour speed restrictions and imposing fines on motorists. It's all part of, apparently, rowing back the war on motorists. But is there really a war on motorists, or is it a straw man? James?
To me, it always seems like one of those slightly kind of made-up culture war issues to invent a division that I'm not sure necessarily exists, although I am speaking from the perspective of a metropolitan non-motorist, so perhaps one of those people who is on the wrong side of this culture war. But, you know, I think when you look into it, you know, I don't think motorists are an oppressed minority. You know, they're richer. We know that the richer people are, the more likely they are to drive further. I kind of find this idea that this oppressed minority a slightly difficult thing to buy, I think.
What do you think, India? I mean, it's obviously all born out of what happened in Uxbridge, where the Tories feel that they hung on to that Boris Johnson's old seat because of the ULEZ. They've really weaponised the 20-mile-per-hour thing in Wales. I think more people now have signed the petition than live in Wales, possibly. So they clearly think that there's legs in this.
Yeah, I agree with James. I think it's a kind of manufactured thing. It's exasperating trying to get around London at 20 miles an hour or less, you know, sort of crawling along. But it's necessary, and I understand why it's happened. You know, a black cab driver or an Uber driver might feel differently. But cars, everybody has them, and they are not good. They are, if you care about the environment, you know, millions of cars whizzing around emitting whatever they're emitting is not a great idea. So it's a kind of difficult thing. But basically, I think this is a kind of, the idea that there's a war on motorists is manufactured.
It's also,
what do you think? I'm interested in what you think.
Well, I mean, I think the risk with these things is that so far into a Conservative government, if you're vowing to end the war on motorists, then there's only one
person or party
who started the war.
Yeah,
it's this weird oppositional tone to take. Like 14 years into your government,
and actually, the, you know, vowing to block councils from introducing 20-mile-per-hour speed restrictions, that feels a little bit like I've blocked seven bins and blocked meat chat. You know, there is no plan to introduce 20-mile-per-hour speed limits across the UK, across England, like they have in Wales, because that's his government's policy.
It's kind of like this sort of, I wonder if it's like a self-perpetuating style of doing politics that stems from when all the statue stuff kicked off years ago, and every single, you know, if you feel like you can turn every single thing into a culture war, and I don't really know that cars count as a culture war, if you can just perpetuate this kind of us versus them oppositional style politics, maybe they're just kind of thinking they can keep wringing success out of this way of doing things that, you know, was happening with statues and, oh, I don't know what other stuff was going on when the culture wars kind of kicked off a few years ago. And you just think you can fit everything into this paradigm. Maybe that's the way to do things.
The other thing that's slightly, because the whole point of the 20-mile-per-hour zones introduced by councils, they can put them outside schools or shopping centres. I mean, it's quite, I mean, there is a risk that if he intervenes, you know, the council says we want to make 20 miles per hour outside this school, and somehow the government stops them doing that, and then somebody got run over. I mean, it's you know, there's a reason why.
Yeah, it's not like they're doing kind of motorways or important A roads or anything like that. And I think, I don't know, doesn't everyone just think that more pedestrians and fewer cars are just a nicer, just happier place to be? Yeah. I wonder how many people would really disagree with that.
A cap on the number of hours a day that cars are banned from bus lanes could also be introduced. I mean, we're one step away from a Cones hotline. where John Major said, basically, he was in his car, wasn't he? He got annoyed that there was a lot of traffic cones on the motorway. So he set up a hotline so you could ring in and say, this is obviously before your time, James.
It is before my time. It doesn't feel like a government fizzing with exciting new ideas to make everything better, does it?
Possibly not. But it's all right, because multiculturalism is now in their sights. After Suella Braverman made her speech in Washington this week, saying multiculturalism was a misguided dogma that had failed, Rishi Sunak repeatedly declined to say whether he agreed with his own Home Secretary. They both talked about Leicester. The Home Secretary said multiculturalism in Leicester had failed because it made no demands of the incomer to integrate and always and allows people from different nationalities and ethnicities to live parallel lives. Rishi Sunak then said this in response.
My mum's from Leicester, so it's a place that I know incredibly well. I have many happy memories there. My family are still there. And I think this is something that's incredible about our country, is that it is a fantastic multi-ethnic democracy.
What do you think of this, India?
I think not very much of this. I'm completely appalled by it, actually. And one of the many things I'm appalled by is that somebody who benefited from multiculturalism to the point where their Home Secretary of the UK should claim it's a failed thing and use incredibly provocative and violent language to make her point. I completely disagree with her. I think it was a dreadful thing to say. I also think she was talking about Muslims. She was, you know, she's talking about certain communities who keep themselves to themselves. Martin Samuels actually has written very well about this in today's paper, much more persuasively than anything I could say now. But I think the idea that parallel lives are a problem in the first place, you know, people in the country live parallel lives to people in the city, immigrants to English people who live in Spain live a parallel life to Spanish people, etc., etc., etc. The idea that you have to amalgamate, which, by the way, lots of people do. I'm the product of such an amalgamation. My mother is Pakistani. My father was Belgian. Here we are in the UK. The idea that amalgamation doesn't exist. I think they're like, I don't know, a million, I think, mixed race people in the UK. I mean, it's just, I found the whole thing really, really offensive. Certainly, there's a conversation to be had about multiculturalism, and certainly it's not a topic that should be kind of brushed under the carpet. But the ferocity of her argument, of her completely flawed argument, in my view, I found really revolting.
It was interesting, actually. I was chatting to a cabinet minister, and they were saying, look, I'm on the right of the party. And most of the things, and he said, well, I would say this, but, you know, lots of people are on the doorstep are quite right-wing, and, essentially we sort of reflect back to them what they want. But he said they've got to be really careful, this sort of overreaching, the substance of what Suella Braverman was saying about the definition of refugees was something that actually the last Labour government had looked at in a changing world and greater volatility and movement and all of that. Maybe there is an argument for revisiting some of those things. But he said the risk is you massively overreach and the siren voices. And actually, it backfires on me. It's not one of those things that if there are lots of people who are a bit on the right, you don't get even more people if you dial it right up to 11. What you actually do is you lose people because everyone starts getting a bit squeamish. And so you end up with a very thin slither of support on the, not, I'm not going to say far right, but much further to the right. And you lose the sort of centre-right base that you might have had before.
Yeah, I agree. And it just doesn't seem to reflect. I mean, there are plenty of problems with Britain Uni. You can talk about our failure to build housing, our problems with infrastructure. But actually, if you're going to look at things we do well, I'd say multiculturalism is probably one of them. I think we have among the highest rates of people of different races marrying each other in the world. There was an interesting survey from King's College London that came out earlier this year where they surveyed, I think, across virtually every country in the world saying, would you feel comfortable living next door to someone of a different race and or of a different faith? And by that measure, we were the third most tolerant country in the world, I think after only Sweden and Brazil. In a global context, you know, we're basically getting it as right as it's possible to get. And it seems weird that this thing, which actually is a success story for Britain, is you're moaning about when there is obviously a lot of stuff that in a global context we are getting wrong, like building houses and, you know, managing to get a train line anywhere useful. So it just seems like a weird focus.
Yeah, and it, and as lots of people pointed out, that her speech this week was probably as much about a future leadership bid than any logical plan to rethink policies.
Something to look forward to.
Well, let's move on to talk about the radio. Apparently, researchers from the University of Barnet and the University of Sussex have studied viewing habits of 21,000 people over 3 months. Amongst other things, they found that those that listen to a lot of radio were found to have more trust in people and greater overall well-being and life satisfaction. So the very act of listening to this could be good for you. That's why people need to hear about you bashing away at your column, James. Yeah,
nothing is more nourishing than listening to that.
Yeah.
That's right.
Do you agree, India?
Yes, I do. I have the radio on most of the time and I find it, I love it. I love radio. I love radio more than, actually, is that true? Do I love radio more than TV? Easily as much as TV, possibly slightly more. I like everything about it, particularly your programme.
Well, that's quite right. Do you know what, actually, the truth is, I don't really like speech radio. I mean, obviously, I listen to it more of it now because I'm doing it, but I'm a big fan of music radio. I have the radio on all the time, just, you know, in the background.
Does it say, this research, does it specify whether they're talking about speech radio
that's
or
a good
music
point.
Radio?
Is it just having, because it's the old thing of, like, putting the radio on for the dog, isn't it, before you leave? Is it just the act of having burbling in the corner? I don't know is the answer. Yeah. What do you think, James? Do you like the radio?
Yeah, well, I'm more of a podcast person than a radio person.
God, you're so young.
But is it that different? I think it's just nice to have voices in the background. I think it's kind of comforting, and I can obviously see why it cheers you up, because my mood has always improved.
Do you tune in and out of the podcast, or do you kind of listen? Because I find if I listen to a podcast, I have to concentrate on the podcast. I can't really kind of multitask. I can't be writing something with a podcast on in the background, but I can write with the radio.
I wouldn't write or try and work with a podcast on the background, but I wouldn't necessarily always listen to it. I think a lot of podcasts are kind of atmospheric burbling, so I'll do it while I'm, you know, making my dinner. And I won't always be concentrating on absolutely every single thing they're saying, but the kind of voices are comforting, and I think that's nice.
Mm. I've recently, I hadn't done it properly really before, but tried an audio book. And I find it's quite hard work, concentrate. I find that
audiobooks.
I've just drift off a little
bit. Because you really have to follow the story or the argument or whatever. Whereas a podcast, just people chatting and you can take it or leave it. And then.
And it's partly because I need to try and get a book. I need to try and read a book because I'm interviewing Bernie Taupin in a couple of weeks at Cheltenham. And God, I was never going to get around to reading it. So I thought, well, I'll download the thing. And I could do like a couple of chapters of driving in the car, and then I suddenly realise I've just drifted off.
And you have to go all the way back.
Thinking, and then it's, you know, and then before you know
it. And then it's quite hard to find your way back to exactly where you lost concentration.
Slightly tuned out. But anyway, the book is very good. It's not a criticism of the book, but I think you have to really be listening in a way that it turns out you're not if you're listening to the radio. I think you're right.
Yeah, I mean, some people, my mum just non-stop audiobooks, but I don't know how she does it. I would not concentrate like that.
It's Matt Johnny on Times Radio. I'm not saying it's a quiet news day, but the BBC News channel currently has a sort of breaking news ticker saying lost school jumper found on roof after 20 years. That's on the national broadcaster. They found an old jumper on a flat roof. Well, more on that as we get it. India Knight and James Marriott are still here. Now, James, you wrote in your column this week. You were talking about conversation and how there's basically a lot of it about, and particularly in podcasts you spend a lot of time listening to. But then you wrote about how conversation can be artful. And you said, a few conversations in my life have left me elated. The feeling you get after hearing a thrilling piece of music or watching a great film. Is this all just at 10:30 on a Friday morning?
Yeah, I was talking only about you.
Yeah.
I thought you'd pick that reference up.
Yeah, I leapt on that. We thought we'd get some, try to discuss the value of a good conversation, how to get better at it. Faye Short is a psychologist and professor in the School of Human and Behavioural Sciences at Bangor University. Hi, Faye.
Hello there.
So go on then, give us some top tips. How do we make good conversation, or what should we avoid doing so we don't make bad conversation?
Well, I think it depends on what you want to get out of the conversation. If you want to connect to people, if you want to be making a real link with another person, then to me, the absolute key to a good conversation is actually listening. It's not necessarily what you say about yourself, it's how you listen to other people. And active listening isn't just sitting there in silence. It's actually more about the questions you ask, how you actually engage with what they're telling you. The reality is that most of us like to talk about ourselves. And when we talk to people, we tend to talk a lot about ourselves and don't necessarily listen to other people all that much. The more we do of that, the more we can actually learn about them and connect.
And is that, so is the way of sort of tricking a conversation is to self-consciously ask more questions of the other person?
I like your use of the word tricking, like I'm trying to trick somebody into thinking I'm a good conversationalist. I think it's more that once you start listening to people, you realize that they're actually really interesting and then you want to listen more. So you stop. You might start by doing it really purposefully and intending to focus on someone else, and you might have to actually train yourself to do that a little bit more. But once you get into it, you probably find that you're just really fascinated by other people. Other people are amazing. Even when they have stories about lost jumpers on roofs, they're actually really interesting. And the more you realize that, the more you want to hear from them and the more they want to then talk to you.
I don't think everyone is really interesting. I think there were some really boring people who I'd not like to concentrate on listening to.
I know, but what do you do? Faye, that's a good point. What do you do when you find yourself trapped with someone who is a conversational cul-de-sac?
Well, I'd be interested to know who you think is really, really boring. I mean, can you admit that on the radio?
Theresa May. Really hard work. Really hard work in a conversation.
Well, I wonder if you were able to make Theresa May feel a lot more comfortable conversing with you, maybe she would open up more and disclose and make it more interesting.
So it's my fault, Faye. India, how do you approach someone who's difficult to talk to?
Well, if I have the energy, see, quite often I find I'm not interested in, I mean, I love great conversations and I agree with James, they can be exhilarating almost, but sometimes I can't quite be bothered. Like if you're sitting next to somebody at dinner and you think, this person isn't saying anything terribly interesting and I'm never, ever going to see them again in my for the rest of my life. This is it. These 2 hours are the only time I'm going to meet them. Then I'm not particularly interested in revealing my own sparkling conversational skills. But otherwise, I think everybody basically likes being interviewed. Everybody, as your guest was just saying, everybody finds themselves fascinating. So if you're really, really stuck, just kind of do a light interview and they're delighted to be talking to you and remember you as a very charming person. Even though it's been a very one-sided conversation and all that's happened is that they've talked about themselves, which has made them very happy.
Faye, is there a great question that never fails to ignite a conversation?
I think a great question is probably trying to find out what somebody's interested in and ask them about that. That's when people really light up, and it can be any topic in the world. You know, somebody could be talking about trains or jumpers or a TV show, but when they start talking about something they're really interested in, that's when you start to get somebody just lighting up. And actually, you can learn an awful lot from that. But I go back to my first comment, which was, it depends what you want out of the conversation. Because you're absolutely right. If you're sat next to someone and you're not actually that interested, then it might be that you don't particularly want to explore what's interesting to them.
But then you also don't want them to come away from the conversation thinking you're dreadful. That's the, you know. the worst conversation is this, how are you? Yeah, well, you? Yeah, we're very well. Mm. So how are things? Very good. Very good. You? Yeah, no, very well.
Yeah, although I wonder if the worst conversation is, tell me about the thing that you're really, really interested in, and then they say something like, oh, well, I really love train spotting, or, you know, let me tell you about my model railway. And then you go, oh, God, I really, now I have to listen to this person's interest. which doesn't interest me.
But if the point is, if they're really into it, excited,
that could be worse. That could be worse.
Oh, I'm afraid I don't agree, because when they're really excited and they start telling you, that rubs off on you. You start getting excited with them. If somebody's sharing something that they're really passionate about and they've got all of this information, actually, I find that really inspiring. And I get
What if they're really passionate about, I don't know, copper piping?
India Knight and James Marriott, then, of course, you can read them both in the Times and the Sunday Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, it's 30 years since Back to Basics.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the Redbox podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
Today we go back 30 years.
Back to life, back to reality. Back to life, back to reality. Back to life, back to reality.
The old values, neighbourliness, decency, courtesy, they're still alive. They're still the best of Britain. They haven't changed. And yet somehow people feel embarrassed by them. Madam President, we shouldn't be. It is time to return to those old core values. Time to get back to basics, to self-discipline and respect for the law, to consideration for others, to accepting responsibility for yourself and your family, and not shuffling off on other people and the state.
On October the 8th, 1993, John Major used his party conference speech to issue that rallying cry for nostalgia. The so-called Back to Basics speech was designed to draw a line under a run of financial, ethical and sex scandals, economic turmoil and political infighting, which had beset the Conservative government just 18 months after securing a shock election win.
I'm absolutely delighted with the outcome of the general election. May I say firstly that I feel deeply honoured to have been given the opportunity of continuing the work I've started in the last 16 months. It's been an exhilarating 16 months, and it is the most enormous privilege to have the opportunity of serving as Prime Minister.
Since that moment of triumph followed only months of pain. There was Black Wednesday in September 1992.
Today has been an extremely difficult and turbulent day. Massive speculative flows continue to disrupt the functioning exchange rate mechanism. The government has concluded that Britain's best interests are served by suspending our membership of the exchange rate mechanism.
That was the Chancellor, the then Chancellor, Norman Lamont, on Black Wednesday. Almost simultaneously, David Mellor, his Heritage Minister, John Major's Heritage Minister, faced a barrage of stories about his affair with the actress Antonia de Sancha and allegations about who had paid for a holiday. In May 1993, Michael Mates resigned over his links with a fugitive businessman, Asil Nadir, who had fled to Cyprus rather than face questions over a fraud investigation. Mates had famously given Nadir a watch with the inscription, "Don't let the buggers get you down." So in that speech, the party conference speech in October 1993, John Major urged a return to traditional Tory values, to go back to basics. But the drip, drip, drip of controversy just kept on coming. In the autumn of 1993, there were a run of stories about the Transport Minister, Steve Norris, including the revelation that he had five ministers. At Christmas 1993, Tim Yeo, an outspoken supporter of the Institute of Marriage, quit as an Environment Minister after it emerged he'd started an affair with a Tory councillor, Julia Stent, at the Tory conference the year before and had a child with her. David Ashby, Tory MP for Leicestershire North West, was revealed to have shared a bed in a French hotel with a man who was not his wife. In January 1994, Alan Duncan quit as a ministerial bag carrier over buying a council house on the cheap. Then Gary Waller was revealed to have fathered a child with another MP's secretary. Stephen Milligan, the Conservative MP for Eastleigh, was found dead at home, naked but for a pair of stockings and suspenders, with electrical flex tied round his neck and an orange in his mouth. Then Harley Booth, the 47-year-old married MP for Finchley, resigned as a parliamentary private secretary over revelations of a kissing and cuddling relationship with a 22-year-old researcher. And they just kept on coming. In March that year, Michael Brown, the Tory MP for Brigham Cleethorpes, resigned as a whip after going on holiday with a 20-year-old man under the then age of consent of 21 for same-sex relationships. After all that sex, there was money too. Along came the Cash for Questions scandal. Four Tory MPs, David Tredinnick, Neil Hamilton, Graham Riddick and Tim Smith, were accused of offering to ask questions in the Commons in return for money. In February 1995, Alan Stewart resigned as a junior Scottish minister after waving a pickaxe at a group of protesters. His affair emerged later. In March 95, Robert Hughes resigned as a Transport Minister over his affair. In April, Richard Spring quit as a ministerial bag carrier over a three-in-a-bed sex romp. That same month, Jonathan Aitken was Chief Secretary to the Treasury, accused of doing deals with the Saudi Arabian princes. He sued The Guardian and World in Action, vowing,
"If it now falls to me to start a fight to cut out the cancer of bent and twisted journalism in our country with the simple sword of truth and the trusty shield of traditional British fair play, so be it."
He was later found to have lied in court and ended up in prison. On and on it went into 1997. The married father of two, Gerry Hayes, Conservative MP for Harlow, was revealed to be having an affair with another man. Piers Merchant, the married MP for Beckenham, was caught having an affair with a Soho nightclub waitress and later a parliamentary researcher. The drip drip really did become a torrent. Well, the man tasked with trying to clear all that up was Howell James. John Major brought him in November 1994 as the Prime Minister's political secretary. Howell James remembers the back to basics speech well.
It was the 93 party conference, and he wanted to get the conference back to sort of kitchen table issues, you know, our schools, education, crime, law and order, housing. You know, these are the things the Conservative government should be worrying about and getting right. And he wanted to make a speech that said we need to get back to, you know, basics on these big issues that concern the public. Let's stop disappearing up our fundamental, you know, worrying about the things that Westminster can obsess about. And let's start thinking about the things where the electorate are really concerned about how it affects their own home life and their families. That's what the speech was intended to be, as I understood it. What happened was it was spun, and I think it was spun, you know, I don't think there was malevolence here, but I think there was a sort of, there was an appetite to turn it into something it wasn't quite, which is, we're going to be the party of family values, we're going to be, you know, back to basics in terms of good behaviour, high moral standards and all of this stuff. Very dangerous territory, as every politician subsequently has discovered. And it was that interpretation of the speech, more than the speech itself, that then, of course, did come back to haunt him, because we had this litany of MPs doing the most extraordinary thing.
And it was quite extraordinary. And yeah. I went back and I thought, because is it a bit like, you know, I don't know, sometimes you think, oh, there was a lot of that happened in politics, and you go back and it happened twice, but it felt like a lot. The list of,
yeah,
he was having an affair, he was... Yeah. Taking
yeah.
money,
yeah.
he was having
left
an affair.
Left his wife for a man.
He was
left three his, you affairs, know, had three an illegitimate kid.
All of that.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah,
And
yeah.
so at that point...
And it kept going,
it just
right
kept
up
on
until
going.
The first fortnight of the 97 election, where various things popped out in the tabloid press. And literally, I remember John Major turning to me and looking at me and said, I mean, is this real? Are these people really doing this? What is going on out there? You know, he just shook his head in despair.
And in terms of his approach to the job, the characterization that he obsessively read all of the media and it sort of weighed heavily on him, you know, the different prime ministers take a different approach to the media and what people are saying about him. Is that a fair sort of characterization?
It is, and we did our level best to try and stop it. He did. Early mornings were, you know, a busy time in the prime minister's flat, because the boxes, he'd get up very early and do the boxes if he hadn't done
the red boxes.
The red boxes,
yeah.
Full of parliamentary, full of papers from the private office and from the political office, you know, speeches to approve, agendas to approve, you know, travel trips to agree, you know, schedules, all sorts of stuff, policy papers. And you wanted to rescue your papers from the box, obviously. And John Major liked to talk about what was in the box. So too often he would put, please refer, at the top of the paper. And you'd go up there and you'd want to refer immediately, because then you wanted to know what to do. You know, was, am I going ahead with this, you know, this visit to wherever? And are we going to do these different visits? And if we are, then we have to set a whole lot of things in train to get the programme agreed and to go out and then deliver it. So you wanted him to agree this, so we'd go up there first thing, and that would be the moment where you'd sort of try and capture him to go through what the policy issues were and what, you know, the programme was. And that's where you would get the sort of the raw, unexpurgated John Major about, you know, his thoughts for the day and what he hoped was going to happen or not. And as you say, even at that point, at like 7:30 in the morning, there were times where he said, have you seen what they've said about me in X or Y? And I go, no, Prime Minister, I haven't had a second to look at those yet. And, you know, he would rifle through the papers. He'd even rifle through the weekly magazine, so the Spec or the New Statesman, to find, you know, he'd spot stuff. He had just an unerring nose. He'd find it. You know, the first edition of The Standard would come in. But bear in mind, we were living in a different age. Yeah. This was his version of Twitter obsession. Yeah. You know, as soon as the paper came in, the Evening Standard came in, he'd walk towards it in the hallway at number 10 and leaf through it. And he would always walk into the private office and look at CFAX. Who remembers CFAX? You know, the CFAX was sort of imprinted on the screen of the television.
Was this wanting to know what was going on in the world, or wanting to know
Both.
What the world was saying about him?
Both.
Yeah.
Both. He wasn't self-absorbed in that way, but he was a sort of one-man polling machine. You know, I'd watch him going around receptions, you know, and talking to people, and saying, did you see the news tonight? What? And he'd be testing them for what they remembered or what messages came over most powerfully to them. And, you know, he was always very interested in people's sort of reaction to it. And he would listen. He would listen. It's a good quality in a politician.
Yeah.
I commend it.
Howell James, political secretary to John Major from 1994 until the election. in 1997. Well, two people who were there reporting on all of that were Eleanor Goodman, who's political editor of the Channel 4 News at the time. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi.
And Phil Webster, former political editor of the Times. Hi, Phil.
Good morning.
So, Phil, take us back then to October 1993. From what I've seen, I've watched most of the speech back, actually. John Major seemed in quite good fettle. He thought it was, you know, and at the end he thanked the party members for their loyalty and so on. How did the speech land at the time?
Well, Howell James was quite accurate there in suggesting that the way it got reported in the end was not quite what John Major had expected, I think. It was meant to be an appeal for a return to old-fashioned values. But it was spun, and I remember us all grabbing John Major's briefer after the speech, and he allowing himself to agree with us that it could well have related to some of the misdemeanors, misbehavior that was going on at the time involving Tory MPs. So it very quickly became a disaster for John Major. It wasn't portrayed in the way I don't think he intended it to be portrayed, but it suddenly became a speech about Major telling his MPs to behave, stop having affairs, this, that, and the other. So it landed badly for him, and he should really have realized that making a speech like that, with so many of those stories already out there, the ones you've enumerated this morning, there was little chance that it was going to be interpreted in any other way. There was a line in the speech at the end, of course, about family values. So there was enough. And his briefer was rather enthusiastic in telling us what we wanted to hear, that this was all about telling Tory MPs to get their act together.
I don't know. When we sort of set out looking at this, I sort of had in mind that actually it wasn't going to be as bad as we remembered. That, you know, actually when people talk about, you know, the scandals which Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson's MPs have had, it always feels like there were actually more than there were. When I actually went back and looked at the full list and the length of time it took me to read them all out, it was what do you think was behind that? Was it just the arrogance of, you know, having been in power for so long? Was it that actually this had always gone on in Westminster, people turned a blind eye to it, and suddenly there was a market for it in the papers and so on? What was going on in the Tory party where everyone seemed to be in someone else's bed?
Well, talking to somebody who was in the Whip's office at the time, I think his view was that it had always gone on. I think one of the problems was that the person who actually wrote the speech, who, as I understand it, was someone called Nick True, who went on to do great things in the Lords for the Tory party, and the person who span it, Tim Collins, who went on to be a minister, both of them had a slightly naive view of life. And they didn't really realise what they were doing. But the extraordinary thing is that John Major didn't, because at the time, of course, he had finished an affair he himself had with Edwina Curry. And it is said that every Sunday night, when the Sunday papers were about to land on the press officer's desk, he would ring up and say, is anything in them? Like a man who thought, my God, they might have got a hold of that. So it's almost as if he read the speech without really absorbing it, which defies, you know, you can't imagine he really did do that. I think it was partly that we in the press were determined to expose it all, but also in terms of the more serious things about the allegations of corruption and abusing their positions as MPs. That was a symptom of the Tory party having been in office too long. And certainly the way it played was to reinforce the idea, as Major says in his autobiography, that the Tories had been in office too long and become casual with power, which, of course, is something that Rishi has to be very aware of.
And I suppose, actually, Phil, there's that sort of element of if the public perception is you're on the downward slide, is that sort of thing that, you know, when you're on the up, everything you touch turns to gold, and when you're on the way down, everything you touch turns to something much worse. And that actually, you know, when the new Labour government came in, there were affairs and allegations and sleaze, but because they were sort of riding high, it doesn't become the sort of defining narrative. Whereas,
You know, every Tory MP who looked at someone who wasn't his wife became front page news precisely because it fitted that narrative.
Yeah, it was a government on the way out. There was great surprise, of course, when Major won the 92 election. It hadn't been expected until right to the last moment. There was the polls changed very late on. He'd been expected to lose that election. And the moment he won it, he was in trouble with Europe. The anti-Europeans in his party were on the rampage immediately over the Maastricht Treaty. And then this string of affairs, some of them quite amazing, you know, the wife complaining that her husband MP had run off with another man, and he admitting that he had slept once with a man after a rugby do, but that he hadn't been unfaithful to his wife. All that kind of madness was going on, and it was redolent of a party really on the slide. Ellen is right, of course. I mean, John Major couldn't really, he couldn't be sure that the revelations that were to come in 2001 from Edwina Curry, he could never be sure that they weren't coming along before then. And of course, if she had chosen that time to make the revelation she made in 2001 through her diaries and also through the Times, of course, it might have finished him on the spot. And I think she has said that herself since. But no, it was a dying government. And you're right, if those things happened under Labour in the early years, they didn't get as much prominence. But I suppose everybody was out to knock that government at the time, and the MPs and their behaviour. Of course, we had the cash for questions as well at the end of it, MPs being paid to raise questions. It was astonishing, three MPs admitting to that. They were on the way out, and they were out for a long, long time.
And so are we wrong to draw parallels with today, Eleanor? I mean, actually, we have seen, I mean, I don't think in terms of volume, we've seen quite the same level of scale. No,
if you take the duration of this parliament so far, there may not have been the volume, but in terms of the depth of the allegations, i.e. that you have a prime minister who is alleged to have consistently lied, that is far more serious than being caught in bed with another man, isn't it? But I think that what is the same and what is worrying for Rishi is, as I say, the whole idea of this being the end of a era, that it's time for a change, even if you're not particularly enthusiastic about Labour, well, that you might as well have a change. That is the parallel to draw. And in a way, when I listened to Rishi's speech last week on the environment, I could sort of feel an echo of back to basics, insofar as he was trying to make a connection with the electorate and say, we care about the things you care about, we're not interested in woke issues, whereas in a way John Major was saying rejecting political correctness. There was a similarity there, but I don't think there was the great big danger in it, i.e. a peg in which to hang all future allegations. I would have thought all political speeches are now combed for those kind of pitfalls. And again, it's a sign of perhaps how badly served John Major was, that it was spun in the way it was. I mean, I remember thinking at the time, we all rushed downstairs, as Phil said, in the ballroom at Blackpool, and listened to this young man spinning it. And you sort of, you could see these stories being written on everyone's faces. You just, wow, is he really saying that? Yeah. And you knew that wasn't really what John Major had meant, but you knew you couldn't, as a journalist, ignore it, because if you did ignore it, it would look as if you'd missed the story. So there was this sort of journalistic dilemma as to whether you went with what John Major had wanted, was trying to say, or what could be extracted from it. And I'm afraid we all went with what could be extracted. Interestingly, actually, I was looking at some front pages, and The Guardian played it fairly neutrally. It took a bit of time, I suspect, for the likes of The Sun and The Mail, and I'm sure Phil, to pick it up that way, for it to really run. And then you couldn't stop it. It was like a hare going round and round and round. I mean, all of us yapping after it.
You talked about the Rishi Sunak not making a hostage to fortune that way. I mean, actually, when all the Boris Johnson stuff was sort of all blowing up, I mean, the fact that he stood outside Downing Street when he became Prime Minister and said, this government will have integrity, professionalism and accountability at every level, that came dangerously close to being a thing. But you wonder actually during an election campaign whether or not Labour might dust that off. Phil, your assessment of the parallels with today, the what happens in the apparent dying days of a government when the opposition are well ahead in the polls?
Well, yes, we are in precisely that position. I would say that the Rishi Sunak has probably started his last campaign to save it for the Tories a bit earlier than the Tories did back in 96, 97. It's obvious that Sunak's going to have let's say the election is going to be next May, he's going to have several months of policy announcements. There is the parallel is obviously there. This government has been in 13 years, and similarly, it was a similar length of time back then. It was coming up for 18 years in 97. And there comes a point in every political cycle when the voters have just had enough. Certainly under Boris Johnson and Liz Truss, it was obvious from the polls that the voters had had enough and were ready to change. It appears not to be changing. He's making a pretty strong fist of it in terms of tearing up quite a lot of the policies that his predecessors brought in, net zero, other things. But whether it will be enough, it wasn't enough. Back to basics was never going to be enough back then in 96, 97. And one doubts very much at the moment whether net zero and a weakening of net zero is going to be enough now, but we will see.
But it's interesting, isn't it? We wouldn't have remembered that speech at conference 30 years ago. I mean, remind me of a speech that was made 31 years ago or 29 years ago. It's only because of the line of Back to Basics that it's become immortalized. It's strange, isn't it? I'm interested that Phil says next May for an election. Can we just pick him up on that?
Yeah, I don't fully disagree. I think it could have been my in the great 97-92 debate. I think it's 74. I think he could go early, and then Labour might fall short of a majority, and then we'll have to have another election.
Yeah, I think May is a possibility. A, you get him out on the same day as the local elections, but I think it's also the London mayoral election, and there the whole issue of the environment could be used to the Conservatives' advantage. We saw what happened in Uxbridge over ULEZ. And would it be an opportunity for the Tories to present themselves as the motorist friend? I don't know. It just strikes me that a government hanging on to the death, there's nothing to gain in that at all. It hasn't worked before. What's the point in carrying on till January 2025?
Yeah,
you're going to take a
hammer. What's the point in going early when you look at Theresa May?
And that's all we've got time for on today's episode. Get in touch all the usual ways. You can email me, matt@times.radio. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.